Welcome to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk into a Bar,
the podcast where we mix a sometimes weird but always delicious cocktail of theology, philosophy, and spirituality.
We're excited to be here with you. We're excited to hold this space, whether you're in your car, cutting your grass, sitting in your living room, or who knows, whatever you're doing. We're glad to be here with you and excited about this conversation today. Today's a major one. It's a serious conversation. We're going to be talking to Duke Kwan and Gregory Thompson about their book that they wrote that is called Reparations, A Christian Call for Repentance and Repair. Now, the word reparations is a jarring kind of decentering word in our culture, particularly for white people. And it's a really important word and a really important concept for us to reckon with. And these guys do an amazing job of it, I thought.
Yeah, it's a really important book. Not an easy read.
Nope.
Don't go into it thinking it's going to be like inspirational necessarily.
Thank God,
there's
right?
There's a lot of history that's difficult to grapple with.
Really painful.
But necessary.
Yeah. Well, before we do that, what treat do you have for us here today, Kyle?
Yeah, changing gears completely here. So today we're drinking a straight bourbon whiskey from Traverse City Whiskey Company. Says it was aged in New American Oak for 3 years or more, which I guess is pretty good. I don't know.
Yeah, better than less than 3 years.
I suppose so. I mean, straight bourbon just has to be two, so I guess they went above and beyond.
What I've heard from my man Joe at Story Hill BKC is that Traverse City, Michigan actually has this little pocket. It's on Lake Michigan, and it has this climate control that's really remarkably similar to a lot of amazing wine regions. And so in Traverse City, there's a lot of amazing wineries. There's a number of distilleries, and they all have this unique dynamic because of the climate in Traverse City. So as soon as he said that, I want to travel to Traverse City and check it out.
Let's take a podcast excursion sometime.
Absolutely. But here we have their whiskey, so let's give it a shot.
Cheers. This is 43%, so not too strong.
On the nose, it's like a citrus for me. You get lemon kind of zest.
Yeah,
yummy.
I blanked and drank before I smelled, but I taste citrus as you say that.
Mm-hmm. It's not a super aromatic nose for me, but it's got a nice, even palate. It's not terribly complex, but all the things that you want out of a straight bourbon.
I think it's really good. I mean, particularly, I'm biased against micro distilleries, and I'm sorry, there's probably like two micro distillers out there listening. Most of those micro distillery, the products from it taste new makey to me. It just takes...
This doesn't taste like that.
Not at all. No. But there is a kind of bourbon that tastes, that the notes are extremely high, and they're bright, they're acidic, they're citrusy. You don't get a lot of the deep fruits and cherries and oaks. Yeah. That's like this to me. This is very, very like bright in its palate. It's enjoyable, but it's not, that's where it is for me.
Yeah, no, that's fair, I think.
It's not not a ton of heat, but enjoyable. It doesn't taste diluted or anything.
Yeah.
I do get like salty candy in the nose.
Mm-hmm. You say candy. I was just going to ask. I don't know as much about bourbon. Is there like some other dessert wines? Are there dessert bourbons? Because this is in that category for me. It's
sweeter
than
bourbons.
I was expecting. Yeah,
it was great. Yeah. I wouldn't put this too far into the sweet spectrum, at least for my palate. But I also have a real sweet tooth. So.
No, I think I've had whiskeys that I smell straight marshmallows. I don't know if you guys have ever had that. This is just a hint of marshmallow for me with some savory notes too. This is fun. This is a good micro distillery that we should support. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I like it. Very drinkable. And I wouldn't feel bad about mixing it with something if I wanted to make an old fashioned.
It'd be great. Yeah.
It's really good to have those around.
Mm-hmm. So Traverse City Whiskey Company.
Nice moves.
Good job.
Yeah.
Duke Kwan and Greg Thompson, thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thanks for having us.
It is great to be here.
Super fun. I'm excited to talk about your book, Reparations. Could you guys tell us about yourselves before we get into this pretty major work that you put together called Reparations? Who are you, Duke Kwan and Greg Thompson?
I am a pastor in Washington, D.C., part of a church that started up about 10 years ago, part of a network of congregations here in the District of Columbia that started up about 18 years ago. And so this is home, wife and three kids, three young kids that are also here, all born here in DC, so this is definitely home, planting long-term roots, plan to be here. Grew up in California for most of my life. A lot of my family's still out there, but came over to the East Coast for college and never went back, which is not common for Californians. But that's the case for me. So here I am, which also makes me a Lakers fan. So you can love me or hate me for that, but that's what it is, man.
Left the coast, but not the team affiliation. I respect that. Absolutely. Duke, what kind of, that was Duke, by the way, Duke Juan. Duke, what kind of church do you pastor? What's the denomination network affiliation?
Yeah, the church is called Grace Meridian Hill. The network is called Grace DC Network, three congregations. And we're a part of the Presbyterian Church in America, so PCA.
Got it. Yeah. Thank you.
So I'm Gregory Thompson, and I am a former pastor, and I'm a scholar of civil rights movement, and really and kind of functioning as an artist of kind of diverse creative background right now. I'm leading a project to build a national memorial of the Underground Railroad outside of Philadelphia. I'm the creative director of a new cocktail bar that's an homage to African-American cultural history called Star and Lantern.
What?
And that's in that's opening in the Philadelphia area. And so I'm based in Charlottesville, Virginia, but I kind of live at this interesting intersection of theology or spirituality, politics around race and racial justice, and essentially the hospitality world, the food world, and that's the space where I'm spending most of my time. Like, I was just over at the restaurant before I came over here, and so trying to pull all those circles together in some coherent fashion.
You got me, Greg. I mean, good grief. I love food. I love civil rights. I love the church. I mean, geez. And yeah, whatever. I'll just stop gushing a little bit, but,
I'd love to talk to you about Star and Lantern if you want. It's going to be an awesome thing.
Yeah. Let's try to get that in before we're done. How do you guys know each other? How'd you wind up writing a book together?
Well, we've been in kind of same broad network. I was also in the Presbyterian Church, and we had known each other for a number of years, but I don't think really had been together more than once over the past 15 years. Then we ended up in a meeting in D.C. the month after the Charleston shootings in 2015, and the two of us were there together, kind of discussing what had happened and what a credible and meaningful response to it would be. And then we just have sort of stayed in touch, you know, over the years. And that's kind of how I think our relationship developed. We have not, it should be said, I don't think we've been together but one time since we signed the contract to write this book because of COVID. So Duke and I only exist in each other's screen.
We're not real.
So was the book one of your ideas, or was it the publisher's idea that came to both of you? How did that work?
I think it was our idea, not the publisher's, but I think really it just bubbled up when we found in each other sort of a rare shared interest in this topic. Obviously, it's not one that many people in our sort of ministry and church spaces have necessarily tackled or embraced. I had the privilege of sharing a talk at a Q Ideas conference a couple of years ago, and that may have been the first time that Greg heard me speak on this publicly. And that sort of, you know, triggered conversations about, hey, you know, you find two unicorns in our denomination that actually want to tackle reparations. Started thinking about what we could do together on the subject. So yeah, the rest is history.
Yeah, I was actually sitting in the audience when he gave the talk, and I had a prior commitment to meet with a publisher the following morning to talk about a contract on a book on MLK. And I texted Duke during his talk and said, I think we need to write a book on reparations together. And I'm meeting with a publisher in the morning. And are you cool with me pitching the idea? It was pretty much that's how I think that's really how it happened. He was doing really good constructive work, and I had been thinking about these issues and thought, we both saw an opportunity that we thought to serve in that way.
Yeah. Well, it's a great book. I just finished it a couple of days ago. It was a challenging read. It was a hard read, but it's an important read. I'm going to ask you the obvious question that I know you get at every interview about this, just to start us off, and I know you have a prepared answer because it's in the book. Why are a white guy and an Asian guy writing a book about African-American reparations?
Well, you know, as we say in the book, we don't know who else should be writing it at one level. I mean, the reparations conversation is by nature a two-party conversation. Those who owe reparations and those to whom reparations are owed. And so we're writing as people who are in a predominantly, but not exclusively, but predominantly white denomination. And we wanted to speak into that audience as people who in some ways represent that community. It's complicated for both of us. Obviously, it's more complicated for Duke because he has an entirely different sort of story in this. But that, so in one sense, we're taking it from the perspective of what we say is the penitent. And we're also doing it as folks who believe in the church and believe the church should take responsibility for it.
Yeah, it does stand out to some folks as being odd, or at least not what they might expect in terms of authorship on a topic like this. But that's been a joy. I think it's important that even though we are who we are, we did labor as best as we could, not only to write and think, but even in our sort of our own development over the years, to really sort of sit at the feet of African-American thinkers, pastors, ministry leaders, and all the rest. And we try to reflect that in the book, that even though we're writing as non-Black people responding in this two-part conversation, that we also did want to do our best to represent not just our own thoughts, but the thoughts of Christian leaders, both past and present, from the African-American tradition.
Yeah, and you sure did that. I mean, that was very, very clear. And that's really a lot of the gut-wrenching stuff for me as we read that. I mean, you start out the book, the introduction got me. I mean, completely 100% hooked just reading that letter from this former slave named Jordan Anderson. I wanted to read this out loud over the, you know, for our listeners, the whole letter, but it's just too long. It's bad listening. We'd waste our time with you guys. But could you let our listeners who haven't read this book, and I think this is going to make them want to buy the book, tell them about this letter, how you found it, how you became aware of it, the history of it, and then just tell them about the contents of this letter, because it is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, I found it online, just browsing through different sources, and especially at a time when I was interested in getting down to original source material, and just a fascinating story of a former slave who once lived on a property in Tennessee, eventually ran away and made a new living in Ohio. And so the whole sort of context of this letter that we have that was written by Jordan Anderson, this former slave, to his former master, just this amazing response to a request, a plea for him to return back to the home. The former master, apparently his property had fallen on hard times and he needed some extra help and wanted his former slave to come back and get things back in order. And so, yeah, just that letter actually sort of not went viral, but it just got some press time some years ago, maybe 10 years ago or so. So it got circulated a little bit and people were chatting about it. But I think a lot of people have forgotten about it. So it was fun for us just to put it back in print and make sure people got their eyes on it, because it really is powerful. And Greg, maybe you can just summarize what the contents of the letter was.
Yeah, well, the essence is, you know, I mean, it's a total masterpiece, this letter.
It is. It is.
But the essence of it is, I appreciate you asking me to come back. I miss the old home place, even though you shot at me on occasion. And I am interested in talking to you about coming back, but the precondition of that is for you to show me your good faith, that you really do want to work together on this and treat me well by paying me what you owe me. And then Jordan Anderson calculates what he is owed over for all the years of service, minus like a tooth extraction and a couple other things, and says, so that'll be $11,000, and please send the money to a certain place.
Incredible.
And if you don't, then there's no way I can trust you to treat me well when I come back, and I don't really need you. And so it was just incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's worth the book right there. Read that letter and it will hook you for the rest of the book. And I mean, the power of the book, one of the powerful things about the book to me was the stories that you tell. I mean, you're just helping us see the history of our nation, helping us see the history of slavery, of Jim Crow, of, you know, the 60s and 70s, the whole dang history of our nation. And in the first chapter, I mean, I was depressed, mm-hmm. by how history repeats itself. You tell the story of the sanitation workers' protest in Memphis in 1968, and after two sanitation workers who were black are killed in the line of work, and the response to that protest that you detail in your first chapter rings so familiar to me, right? Where you say the response, some claimed that Dr. King was stirring up trouble to grab attention. Others claimed that it was a movement of violence that was launched by black nationalists. Others said it was a strategy formed by Northern Union leaders trying to exploit local problems, on and on. That sounded so familiar to me from the summer of 2020 and even till now when we talk about the Black Lives Matter protests. And you had this like 2-week window of a lot of unity, you know, like people get kneeling for nine in the suburbs and in rural areas and all this beautiful stuff. And then all of a sudden it was like, you've had your time now. And then when it continued, it turned just angry and bitter, and you heard all these ideas and these reasons for why this is happening. It's Antifa, or it's they're violent, even though we know 93% of the Black Lives Matter protests were peaceful. It reminded me so much of, and depressed me, in how our nation's history repeats itself all the way up to the present moment. Can you just, you guys are scholars, you guys have researched this. Bring us into that world of history repeating itself and why you might be a little bit hopeful even.
Well, I think one of the things that we have to keep in mind is that of all of the qualities evil has, creativity is not one of them. And it continually, plays the same songs. And I think that these things do repeat themselves just because they're unaddressed. It's like a wound will continue to scab. And so I think part of what we were trying to help people see is that these essentially tropes of deflection that are used by people who want to deny the reality of white supremacy or frankly displace responsibility for our social turmoil onto African Americans and away from white folks, they really only have so many ways they can do that. And they just do it over and over and over again, you know. And some of the people that are talking today, I was joking with Duke today, I was like, some of the stuff that's being said today, it could have been said by George Wallace, you know, or it could be said by John T. Calhoun. And, you know, it's profoundly unoriginal. And the way it thrives is by obscuring itself. You know, I think we're seeing that. And I'm personally hopeful, and I'd be interested to see what Duke says, because precisely for that reason. What we're facing is not new, and it's just compounded evidence. And this moment, like many other moments that we chose not to embrace, this moment does present us with an opportunity to finally address these things, which seem so transparent to us in need of redress.
Just to comment on that last part of the question, one reason why I'm hopeful, and there are a number of reasons, including things as foundational as the power of the resurrection, believing in the power of Christ in the life of the church, truly. Real things can happen in and through the church. So believing in things like that. But what stands out to me, I think in this generation, if I could almost talk like an old dude or something, is I feel like there's more attentiveness to history, I think, than I've seen in generations past, as if I've lived in any other except my own, right? But I just mean there people, you know, one of the things that have obscured these things over the years is when Americans, and especially American Christians, have opted to live under these dense mythologies and then sort of inheriting them as they're passed down from home to home and church to church, but without actually reckoning with history on its own terms, I feel like people are actually going back to the sources and reading for themselves, and more accessible histories are being written as well. And so it's a fascinating thing, I think, to see Christians that are wanting to know truer stories more than I've ever seen. And I think that's actually igniting both a deeper kind of honesty and a penitence, as well as an eagerness to rewrite the story or to overwrite it or to just write new chapters of it going forward. There's a different relationship to history than we've had before.
And if I could add to that, I want to just underscore, this book was not written as an indictment of the church. There are indicting parts of it for all of us. It was essentially written and addressed to the church because we have hope in the church, because we believe that if the people of God actually saw what was happening in this world, and actually committed themselves to the work of reparations, that it would be possible to make profoundly constructive action and, you know, real strides on this. So I believe in the spirit, and I believe in the creative possibility of Christian folk. And so I think that's one of the reasons we were so deliberate about addressing it to the church, precisely because this is a work of hope. And we think that if the church owned this and said, yes, we're gonna figure out what this means and how to respond, I think we would actually start to see movement in this culture.
Wow. We found two guys who have hope in the church. Let's let's drink to that.
Cheers
to
that.
That's right.
Absolutely.
That's right.
Yeah. We tend more towards despair on this podcast, so glad to have
We need more hope. Yeah.
It's a hope in the presence of Christ.
Right. Amen. Yep.
Yeah,
absolutely. I'm there with you.
So I'm glad that you mentioned the historical stuff, because a great strength of the book, I thought, was in the early chapters where, I mean, you could assign some of this as like a pretty decent introductory history to white supremacy in the United States in like an undergraduate class. Like I was talking to my students about it, actually, because we just happened to have our unit on race this week. And so it was fresh in my mind. I mean, there's some really useful stuff in there. You guys have a quite useful, I think, synthesis of a lot of historical scholarship on the concepts of racism and white supremacy. So could you briefly, for our listeners, before we get to the reparations part specifically, tell us what you think racism is, and specifically if you could describe for us your idea of cultural racism, because I think it ties together a bunch of different scholarly strands in a really nice way. So if you could explain what cultural racism and white supremacy are, and then we can talk about the reparative.
Yeah, great. Well, I'll try to do it succinctly. Racism, as we define it, has three aspects to it. The first is the identification of people according to putatively static or unchanging physical characteristics. Two, imputing certain moral and intellectual capacities and correlating them to those physical characteristics. And three, assigning a correlative social value or devalue based on those characteristics. Racism is all of those things as we talk about it. And when we talk about racism as a culture, what we're simply saying is that we have inherited a culture, and American culture has certainly been a culture that did that especially to African-Americans, and not exclusively to African-Americans, but in a distinctive way to African-Americans. And though, you know, we see this happening all over the place now. But so it's not just what's happening in my heart. Racism is not just a broken relationship with somebody of a different, quote, race. It's not even just a sort of a discrete institutional injustice. It's actually an entire cultural system where that traffics in and perpetuates those three features, that we continue to talk about people in these racialized categories, which are a modern invention, that we continue to assign various capacities to them, and we continually reward or harm people according to those signifiers. And that has embedded itself in every institution, and not just in the institutions, but in the interaction between those institutions, into a mutually reinforcing system. That system we refer to as white supremacy for a very simple reason. It is beyond controversy historically that the United States of America privileges those that it designates to be white. Our entire catalog of blood laws from the 19th century is nothing but, and the correlative privileges that were associated with how much white or African American blood you had in you, is an irrefutable, incontrovertible demonstration that this was a basic anthropological logic of this country, and that it continues. And so it what it does is it takes people that it designates to be white, and it elevates them, makes them supreme across all of these different institutional manifestations. And so white supremacy, as we describe it, is not, as we say, hooded dudes in the woods or torchbearers marching through Charlottesville, my town. It is an actual system that advantages those that it deems to be white and disadvantages those that it deems to be not white. I want to say one more thing. This is not to say that all those advantages are equal. It is not to say that the presence of advantage means that those it deems to be white have an easy life. It doesn't mean that. Some just have what Du Bois called the psychological wage of knowing that at least they're not black. And coming from, you know, relatively poor Southern roots myself, I can testify to that. That is true. And so that's what we mean.
If I could just add, you know, that this idea that we try to introduce early on, racism as a culture, we describe it kind of as being an ecosystem, right? So even in the way that that word is used to describe the natural world, what is that? It's sort of this web, network and web of not only organisms, but their relationships with each other, their environment, right? So this includes individual people and institutions and their ideas and what's in the water and what's in the air, all of those things together, which are the source and sum of all these other aspects and dimensions of racism, whether if it's broken relationships or evil ideas or corrupted institutions. The reason why we felt it was important to describe racism as such, as far as the logic of our argument is concerned, is basically to just show how bad and intractable the problem is. That, of course, if racism is just about broken relationships, then let's just hang out more. Or, you know, or if it's just about bad ideas, then let's just read more books. If it's just about broken institutions, well, let's just fix these organizations. We're saying it's all that and more. It goes deeper, wider. It's been longer. It's been harder. And therefore, and this is the simple conclusion out of that, that sort of emerges out of that definition. Therefore, we need something that goes as comprehensive and deep and wide as white supremacy itself has infected our nation. And that is why we need something like reparations. And so it's an argument and a definition that tries to set the stage for the need for something like reparations.
So, I mean, in your first couple of chapters, you do a really good job, guys, of taking us into the darkness and the depth and the disgusting nature of white supremacy in the history of the United States of America. I mean, and you talk about the color line and the call to see white supremacy that is ingrained in our culture when we don't really see it. So can you take our listeners into that world, the color line that functions to keep African Americans and white Americans from seeing one another? And that is a line that runs, you say, deep through the structure of our daily lives, going all the way back to hidden and separated lives on the plantation to our world today. Take us into that world, that color line. It was easy to see then, and it should be easy to see now, but can you just take us into that reality a little bit?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It both is and is not easy to see because, well, I'll talk about that in a second. To talk about the color line, you know, that's obviously Du Bois's phrase. And he was talking about an entire social separation that existed, that was being challenged, that had in fact been challenged through emancipation and through Reconstruction and was never fully resolved. In fact, that line was reestablished in Jim Crow, as he laments in some of his poetry. And the basic idea is that what we were just talking about a minute ago, that this separation of essential selves according to racial categories, and then giving people completely different social experiences based on that. And those two things don't interact except as those who are in power need those who are not in power. And that line is very firmly policed. You know, it was obviously policed in the plantations. It was policed in segregation. It was policed by this hyper hysteria about black-white sexual relationships that were prominent from the 1880s, really through the civil rights movement. And so I think it's a structure that expresses itself everywhere in their educational systems, you know, our laws, et cetera, et cetera. And so there's one sense in which it's really easy to see. I mean, all you have to do is drive through town, and you can drive through various towns. You can see it. Look at educational systems. Look at who's getting free lunch and who's not at school. Like, all these things, you can see it. But on the other hand, it's not easy to see because by nature it was designed to conceal. And that's why we refer to, like, you know, the hidden staircases in Monticello and places like that, because white America not only needs to be in power and to subjugate these other folks historically, it needs to believe that it's not doing it while it's doing it. And that means that it's fundamentally pathological. in nature. And that's a part of the thing. And that's part of what we're seeing right, you know, right now in our own country is this is a system that is predicated on pretending that it is something other than it is. Whoa. That is why people can say, you know, we always treated our slaves real good. Mm-hmm. That is why people can say, you know, black people loved it down in the South with like a straight face. That's why certain people who may or may not have been in the White House over the past 4 years can say, I'm not a racist. When everything that you see taking shape is a reinforcement of a racial order because it is predicated upon self-deceit.
Duke, anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, just to say that that line runs not only right through American society generally, broadly, but also through the church. And it's just as invisible in the life of the church as well. And in fact, church people are sometimes the most blind to those realities, most hidden from it, and most self-deceived as far as wanting to believe the best of themselves and of the church's history, and therefore don't know how to reckon with it or heal those divides and that separation and that blindness because they don't even believe or want to believe that it could be there.
I mean, you kind of answered, Duke, but I want to just go dig beneath the surface a little bit there. Why do you think the church maybe is the most blind? You just said something similar to that. Why is that as a pastor?
Well, I think part of it is we just as much as anyone else cling to sort of the social order. And I mean that both ecclesially as well as more broadly in American society, we don't want disruptions. We like things to be tidy and not unsettled and to actually see things as they truly are is deeply distressing and unsettling. So I think we choose not to really deal with things. I think part of it is our spirituality in the American church is impaired in a lot of ways that gives us this real deep, almost embarrassing inability to confront reality, to tell the truth about ourselves. We're pretty good at telling the truth about others' failures. The world,
yes,
but not our own. What I mean is, we really, truly do not believe in the life-giving power of repentance. Hmm. We don't believe in the grace of confession. We believe these are damaging things rather than things that truly do liberate and restore humanity and the true nature of the church. Reveal the true nature of the church when we tell the truth. So I think we just would rather live under lies, deceptions, because we're afraid and because we're afraid of what we might lose. Yeah, it really is tragic because Christians should be the most courageous to enter into those honest places, the most vulnerable, the most risk-taking. And I don't mean just by going into dangerous countries to bring the gospel to bear around the world. I mean dangerous as in like telling the truth and bearing that kind of risk, even institutional, financial risk. But unfortunately, the church tends to be the most cowardly, at least has been over these centuries.
And I think just to add to that, it's important to remember that American Christianity, broadly conceived, especially we're talking about largely white Protestant Christianity, has always been a de facto statist institution. It has always been one part Christian gospel and one part nationalist mythology. And in fact, has seen itself as the baptizer and the legitimate moral steward of this order. And so the church has put itself in this situation where if it names reality as it is, it has to thereby contribute to its own undoing. And so I think part of our work right now is to name this, because a lot of this isn't really about the history. The history's readily accessible. People who want to know this, they can see it. It's not like we had to go, dig under some pyramid and find some mystery record somewhere. All this is like broadly in the public record. What is happening in our view in the church is the church is incapable of seeing this because it is enslaved to nationalist mythology. And it is this close at every moment to becoming a nationalist cult. And I think we have to understand that. And Christians around the world know this to be true of us. Oh. Okay. This is what global theology is. It's commentaries on this. And so I think we have got to reckon with this, how deeply enslaved we are to cultural mythologies and how much life and vitality and power and sanctimony and self-respect we have derived from believing ourselves to be on the right side of history, assuring ourselves that we're on the right side of history, even as we make our brothers and sisters sit in the balcony.
Man, I'm a former boxer, and that we call like a technical knockout. Like this one's over. It's done. You guys, I mean, the encouraging thing from what you're talking about, Greg, is that this is nothing new, right? This wave of nationalism that we find is kind of like the wave of racism that has been exposed in the last 5 years in our nation's history, which is really like it's always been there. We've just had someone who's empowered it and revealed it. It's kind of an apocalypse almost in the last 5 years of saying it's an unveiling of what's always been there, the nationalism, right. The racism, the tribalism, all of that.
Friends, before we continue, we want to thank Storyhill BKC for their support. Storyhill BKC is a full menu restaurant, and their food is seriously some of the best in Milwaukee. On top of that, Storyhill BKC is a full-service liquor store featuring growlers of tap available to go, spirits, especially whiskeys and bourbons, thoughtfully curated regional craft beers, and 375 selections of wine. Visit StoryhillBKC.com for menu and more info. If you're in Milwaukee, you'll thank yourself for visiting Storyhill BKC. And if you're not, remember to support local. One more time, that's storyhillbkc.com.
So let's talk specifically about reparations then. So I was in favor of the idea before reading the book, but I would have been skeptical of the idea that the church had much of a role to play prior to reading the book. Not because I don't think it's an obligation, a religious and moral obligation, but because I have no real hope that the church could be effective. It seems more likely to me that they would get in the way and make things worse. So if you were to ask me whose job is the reparations, my answer would have been the stereotypical one, the federal government. Mm-hmm. But you make a pretty strong case in the book, I think, that the church has a significant role to play in this. So first, explain what reparations means for our listeners who might not have considered the concept, and then explain what role you think the church plays.
You want to take the first half, Greg?
Sure. So in order to understand reparations, what it means, we understand the white supremacy is not just a cultural order. It's a cultural order that has certain consequences in the world. And those consequences are primarily, by us, reducible to the concept of theft. That is to say, it has been, as Ta-Nehisi Coates calls it, a kleptocracy. And so I think white supremacy, as we say, stole the truth about human beings and also the truth about history through these kind of mythological self-deceits and self-conceits that we were just talking about. It stole also power and, you know, bodily power, political and institutional power. And of course, we're seeing a reestablishment of that theft of political power through voting restrictions like that just took place in Florida.
Yeah.
And it's a theft of wealth as well, both through extraction of wealth from Black communities and the obstruction of their attempts to get wealth and build wealth for themselves. So that's an important foundation, because reparations is simply, it's essentially rolling the tape backwards and thinking, what does it mean to restore what has been stolen and with respect to areas of truth, power, and wealth?
As far as the church's role is concerned, I mean, our argument in the book is a couple of things. One, just by the nature of what the church is and who the church is, that we believe that there's an undeniable missional calling to love neighbor. And this stands as sort of the identity of the church, whether or not the church actually was involved in white supremacist theft. This is what we do and who we are. We go, we love, we fix, we repair, we restore, we heal. This is part of our essential calling. But more specifically, we have this dual identity as both friend and foe of white supremacy throughout American history. And what I mean by that is that we as a church collective have been essential participants in these thefts as perpetrators, accomplices, and willful, negligent bystanders in the face of theft. And so we are therefore responsible corporately to make restitution for these things, to give back what was sinfully taken. But that's also not the whole story either. Like we were saying earlier before, just because we're culpable, if we didn't actually believe in the possibility of the church, we also wouldn't be looking at the church. Mm-hmm. And to be frank, you do see this often out there, people who want to hold the Christian church responsible for things, but don't actually believe the church can do it. It's like, well, you can't have it both ways. Either we're responsible, and there is, even if in a faint and diminished way, yet by the power of the Holy Spirit, sufficient power to make a difference and to do the work. or there isn't. But either way, for us, we believe that the church can actually engage its mission. Let me be clear. We believe that resistance against white supremacy in the church has always been a remnant movement, has never been popular, never probably will be. And yet in the past, Christians and the faithful witness of the church has been able to make a real difference in healing these wounds and making substantial changes across American society. And we believe that that's still the case even today. If we will pay attention to the great moral tradition that we have that tells us, if you stole something, you got to give it back. And when you see a theft, even if you didn't cause it, you need to be a part of restoring it and healing it. That's Zacchaeus. Mm-hmm. That's the Good Samaritan. That's our Bible. That's our Bible. Mm-hmm. And therefore, mm-hmm. we need to pay attention and be faithful to that word.
That's good.
Yeah, and I want to say that our affirmation of the church is not it's not a form of like theological wistfulness. I'm a civil rights scholar. It's inconceivable to think about the Black liberation movement in the United States historically without centering the church. It just doesn't. It doesn't work. And so, again, it's not that we believe in the resurrection and therefore we're making wistful deductions. It is to say we believe in the resurrection and look, the dead have been raised. And so we want to call people to participate in that again by reminding people of the nobility of this history, even though it's a complicated nobility, as all forms of nobility are, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask the simple question that I've, the most basic question and common, you know, deterrent to reparations that I've heard is, I'm not a slave owner. I never owned slaves. I'm not even a racist person. So why should I be responsible for what, you know, generations ago did and all that business? You talk in the book, you say this line that says, we must see ourselves not simply as inheritors of history's nobility, but also as ones who are implicated in history's nightmares. Implicated. That's a strong word. Can you just tease that out just a little bit for our listeners who might be having that offense of like, why should I be responsible for what generations ago did?
Well, this is essentially Frederick Douglass's point that we talk about this, and Americans want to celebrate the 4th of July. Mm-hmm. We want to stand at baseball games and put our hands over our hearts and pledge allegiance. We want to get misty-eyed when the F-16s cruise over the football stadium when our grandsons are standing there. We want to be the inheritors. We do want to take responsibility and enjoy the privileges of things that we contributed literally zero to.
Okay.
Okay. We know how to do that. What we don't want is to somehow imagine that we are implicated in the dark sides of that. And that is a form of willful moral deception. Hmm. And so I just transparently is. And so, I didn't fight in the revolution, but I know how to make hot dogs on July 4th. Like, why is that? Okay. You have to understand that this is an expression of moral sickness and of ideological commitment where we are willing to be so profoundly morally inconsistent and to choose to do something when we are the beneficiaries of that thing and to refuse to do this thing. In fact, to call it morally problematic when it requires something of us. That's a sign, not of intelligence, of not even of a good argument, but of a moral sickness. And so, and this is essentially what Frederick Douglass was saying in his speech on July 5th, you know, when he was like, America has been good to you, but mm-hmm. it has not been good to us, and you were the beneficiaries. And I think we say it in the book, you know, we have to see ourselves not only as inheritors of a city on a hill, but as inhabitants of a city that was built on the bodies of broken children and as beneficiaries of that breaking. Yeah. And unless we can do that, then we are being morally dishonest and also civically incoherent.
Yeah, Ta-Nehisi Coates calls that fair-weather patriotism, right? That inconsistency, mm-hmm. that duplicity and hypocrisy. Yeah. You know, he talks about the need not just to celebrate one side of it, but the whole of it, right? The whole of our inheritance, the good, mm-hmm. the bad, and the ugly, which, again, Christians are not great at doing. We are happy to put out hagiographic biographies and all our great, wonderful American heroes, American Christian heroes. And when it comes to their failings or their slaveholdership and all the rest, we obfuscate and excuse and rationalize
completely
their failings in that way. I want to point out, too, though, that why does it matter for even the person that knows, and maybe they're accurate in knowing that, no, their family did not own slaves. Maybe they weren't even here in this nation at that time. Two parts of the argument that I think need to be made clear. One is that we do have in our Christian understanding over the centuries of the ways in which it's proper to apply the ethics of restitution, that when those obligations are not fulfilled by the original perpetrator, they do get passed on to his or her descendants. And so if the hot goods that were stolen come into the possession of someone that was not the original criminal that took it in the first place, the original thief, well, it doesn't matter. It's not yours. And they were illegitimately and sinfully taken. They need to be returned. And so it's actually not a coherent argument simply to say, well, it wasn't me. You are rendered an accomplice by being a beneficiary. In that sense, whether or not your great-great-great-granddaddy owned slaves or not, in a sense, we all are complicit because we all do benefit from the bounty of this nation that was harvested and built on the backs of slaves. And we need to reckon with that. A lot of the problems that we have are simply just the radical individualism that blinds American Christians from really being able to see corporate realities, corporate dimensions, especially in scripture. It's like, of all people, Christians should be the first in line to say, we are a we. And yet we find ourselves arguing all these strange arguments about, well, no, I was not there and I did not do it. It's like, we're not supposed to talk that way. The Bible doesn't teach us to talk that way. Yeah. We need to deal more corporately with our corporate evils and failures.
And one thing on that, that question also, while it's an important question of political economy, I mean, questions of who owes and to whom and how much, those are like basic questions of political economy that I think really matter. But for church folk, you got to remember, we are a missionary people. And can you imagine going to the mission field, and we've said this before, going to the mission field in Rwanda in 1996 and just being like, I didn't kill nobody in this genocide, so like, why do I have to do something about it? You know what you would do? You would be labeled as a terrible missionary. And you know why you would be? Because you are. And so what's happening here is that Christian folk with a straight face are saying that same thing and thereby betraying their establishment identity rather than their missionary identity. And I think it's a really clear indication whenever somebody says that outside of the context of like a serious conversation about political economy, that they have not yet grasped what it means to be a neighbor to the hurting. And what that requires of us. And it is shot through with self-interest and I think betrays itself to be so.
Yeah, you quote somebody in the book that I just want to mention because it was really powerful to me. So this is in chapter 4. A guy named James Forman, who was a representative of the National Black Economic Development Conference in 1969, and he goes into this church in New York City, causes a disruption during their service, stands at the front and reads out this statement. And when asked afterwards, why did you target the church? Another representative of that group said, because the church is the only institution claiming to be in the business of salvation, resurrection, and the giving and restoring of life. General Motors has never made that kind of claim. So for everything you just said about responsibilities of civic patriotism or whatever, I didn't do that, so I have no responsibility to do anything about it. Just has no place in the mouth of a Christian. That's simply not in the character of Jesus at all.
That's correct. To the extent that we persist in that line of reasoning, we are condemned.
Yeah. No, that's right, that quote. And it's one of my favorites in that section. It's just so striking because it's a simple call to integrity, to live up to our own confessions, creeds, and claims. My goodness. And it's embarrassing because the whole world sees it, right? You know, the name of Christ is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. And it's like, if all we could do is just live up to all that we teach and preach to each other and unfortunately to the world, we would actually be on the hook to do these things and more. We have an integrity problem.
Yeah. So let me ask this. A reader looking for a practical plan of reparations with like numbers and math and stuff is going to be disappointed by the book. You're not going to find that there. But you give a good reason as to why that's not in your book. Can you explain why you didn't include something like that?
Yeah, so I think part of what we wanted our readers to understand is that, A, this is introduction. That's important to say. Second, that we really think people need to sit with this history and sit with this theological tradition that is apparently having so little effect on our moral imaginations. And so really to get into that before rushing in and saying, hey, I've started a fund, you know, I mean, we're in favor of that. And as Anasa says, really hilariously, reparations can't wait for you to finish with your book group. You know, I think she's right about that. But the main thing is because, and as we say in chapter 7, African-American communities can lead the way, can show us what needs to be done. And this isn't morally appropriate for me to say, and here's what it should look like. The whole point is that we have to build these collaborative communities where we are going to figure out how to do this together over time. And so we wanted to, in chapter 7, which is where we take up the kind of the call to reparations, the call to repair, we wanted to center African-American leaders and their voices. And that was not like a summary. It was a moral choice to say, we've laid out all this stuff historically and theologically. Now we're going to turn it to them, and they're going to show us the way if we will just listen to them. And that, I think, is what we, the kind of spiritual discipline of openness, of renouncing control, and actually letting other people lead us into the path of repentance. I think that that's a moral decision that we have to make together.
To add, it is absolutely possible and probable to, even with the best of intentions, to run out the door and to attempt to enact reparations and perpetuate and recapitulate the very white supremacist moral logic that got us there in the first place because of our paternalism, because of our refusal to let go of the steering wheel, because of the insistence that we be the authors of these programs and the holders of the money and the definers of the strategy and all the rest. There needs to be both a real work of reparations and an inner transformation within our communities, which is why the first part of that chapter in chapter 7 talks about becoming a people of reparations, the inner life that needs to become more aligned with the outer work, virtues of repair that need to take place, humility and repentance and confession and relinquishing of control and a revaluation of money and all the rest. Is just as important, not sequential. You know, Anasa has that great quote too, where she's like, well, we can't sit around and just wait, right? But these things happen in tandem together. So we grow and we go, and it's back and forth, in the door, out the door. But we need to slow down a bit, and we're not willing to slow down, and that's part of the problem.
Yeah, and in some ways, the chapter 7 is, it just takes us back to Jordan Anderson. We started with African-American voice and said, this is what it will take. And we ended with African-American voices saying, this is what we will take. And the book is called A Christian Call. And now the obvious thing that is left for the Christian church to decide is there going to be a Christian response? The whole thing is predicated upon a call to response. And I think that that's what we're waiting to see. And in, it is in that response, as we build these relationships and as we listen to these leaders and center their voices, that's where the healing will happen.
So I know you guys have very little time left. I want to ask two last questions. Be quick if you can. But this is super interesting because just a couple of months ago, the city of Evanston, Illinois, became the first U.S. city to actually give reparations, financial reparations, to African Americans. What are your thoughts on, I mean, did you look into that very much? And what are your thoughts on that? I think I have a good guess because of what you just said about the white church just listening to the African American community. But what are your thoughts on what happened in Evanston?
Yeah, I'm aware of it. I don't feel like I know enough about it really to give substantive commentary on that. But from what I can see, it looks like some good initial steps in the right direction.
Yeah, and I would say, without talking about the particulars, I think it's exactly the kind of thing that we want to see. Community-based initiatives based on local collaborations, identifying the problem and coming up with strategies. That is what, in our judgment, the model needs to be. You know, Virginia just signed a bill granting reparations to the descendants of the enslaved people that built the University of Virginia. So I think that these local initiatives, in my view, really are the kind of tip of the spear, and they're very important to cultivate, even as people are trying to, like, figure out if they're going to work or not. The point is to try to experiment and to do that collaboratively and discern over time.
Right, through a process, community-based process, not just running after answers. but through real work, through truth and reconciliation types of commissions, and really grinding through the hard stuff. That's really what we're hoping to see.
Yep. So at the beginning of this conversation, we talked. You talked a little bit about hope, and then we kind of dragged through a lot of despair. Can you finish off, last question, remind us again, guys, why do you have hope that this can happen? Why do you have hope that racism in America, the cancer that is racism in America, can actually be healed and overcome?
Well, the fact of the matter is Christ is risen from the dead. And that act, that fact, reverberates throughout all time and space because of the triune will. Not because we figure some stuff out. And I think at a very fundamental level, we believe that Christ is with those who have been cast down and who's, you know, to quote Howard Thurman, whose backs are against the wall. We believe with Julian of Norwich, you know, with the John of the Cross, with St. Francis, with so many others, Gustavo Gutierrez and Howard Thurman and Martin King, all these people, we believe with them that Christ is with those who have been cast down and that he will vindicate them. And so that's one thing. And we also believe that there are many, many amazing women and men in the Christian church right now who actually want to see healing happen, but they have not been equipped by the church to talk meaningfully about reparations. To the contrary, they've heard their leaders, they've heard their thought leaders, like, misname it and call it dangerous. And so I think that part of what we're wanting to do is say to those people, this is Christian. This other stuff that you're hearing is ideological, okay? And if we would just take this up and do this, we could see something profound and transformative happen. And remember, like, when you study the end of the transatlantic slave trade, and I'm not going to go all Wilberforce on us here, but just keep in mind that, like, we're talking about the most powerful global market in the world, okay? Ends.
Yeah. Yep.
And so I think that we have to keep in mind, both theologically and historically, that this is what the church does. It's not the only thing we do, but it's what we can do. And I believe that we will.
No, that's exactly right. And literally, it's what I would say too, as far as theologically, the hope of the resurrection, the identity of the church, truly as the temple of the Holy Spirit. We believe in the possibilities of what can come out of the church. Not when it rises up, but rather when it kneels down, right? Not when it feels at its strongest, but actually when it feels most weak, which is what this invitation is. But then also to pay attention to history and to say, again, like I said before, it's not at all that we think that the church has always gotten it right, but history tells us that it can do sufficient work, and in Jesus' name, we hope it will.
Well, Duke Kwan, Gregory Thompson, thank you so much for this work. Thanks for joining us. It's been a pleasure.
Great. Thank you so
Absolutely
much, guys.
Our pleasure. Thank you so much, guys.
So the book again is Reparations, A Christian Call for Repentance and Repair. Duke Kwan, Gregory Thompson, go out and buy it as soon as you can. It's really important.
Really? Yeah. That first few chapters, I think, is almost required reading for anyone who wants to talk about race.
Yeah, it really is a good historical summation of not just white supremacy, but like the invention of race, right? Because they have to kind of explain that in order to even explain why it's a fundamental problem in the United States. And so they start in about 1680 and explain how prior to that point there weren't white people.
Right.
That's, you know, a creation of the slave trade. And this could serve as a primer on the history of racism, not just in the United States, but in general. There's much, much more to be said, but they also have extensive footnotes for that. So
absolutely. No, I mean, I think getting under the dark underbelly is our responsibility and our job. And they do a really great job of succinctly bringing us into that dark underbelly without having it like just completely cripple you. Even though I got close a few times, I felt like. I mean, it's rough stuff, but it also feels like that required hard work that feels cathartic when you're doing it. It feels painful, like you can't wait till it's done. And also, you know that it's going to bring about healing. Like it was that kind of reading for me. Really important.
Thanks for listening to A Pastor and a Philosopher Walk Into a Bar. We hope you enjoyed the episode. And if you did, please rate and review the podcast before you close your app. You can also share the episode with friends or family members with the links from our social media pages. Gain inside access, extra perks, and more at patreon.com/apastorandaphilosopher. We're so grateful for your support of the podcast. Until next time, this has been a pastor and a philosopher walk into a bar.